creating a mood board is a DP's version of a script. And I always say in docs, you need to have a plan. Mm. When you just show up and start spraying and praying, it's a mess in the edit. You need to have a plan, but you can't script reality. So you have to be willing for that plan to change and move with it. But you need to have an idealized version thought out so that on those moments where you arrive somewhere and you're not sure where to start, or everyone looks at you and goes, okay, what next? You have something to fall back on.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast, the show in which I interview documentary filmmakers about how they craft the stories they tell. This is a show about documentary filmmaking for documentary filmmakers. And my hope is that it will entertain, educate, and hopefully inspire you to go out and tell some stories of your own. If you're new here, it's great to meet you. Welcome. My name is Austin Meyer, and I am a documentary director and cinematographer based in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I've worked on productions for National Geographic, Hulu, ABC, and I've worked for publications such as the New York Times, Washington Post, and The Atlantic. After taking some time away from the podcast to focus on other projects, I'm super excited to be back talking about storytelling, and hopefully turn this into the home for documentary filmmaking conversations on podcast platforms and on YouTube. Today on the podcast, I'm excited to welcome Luke Forsyth to the show. Luke Forsyth is a Canadian cinematographer with a background in journalism and documentary storytelling. After living and working in Asia and Latin America for over 10 years, Luke returned to Canada, where he now lives in Vancouver, British Columbia. He works on everything that involves visual storytelling, including commercials, high-end documentaries, narrative films, and music videos, but is perhaps best known for stories that reflect the grittiness of the real world. Luke's video and stills clients include the New York Times, the National Geographic Channel, Netflix, Showtime, HBO, ESPN, and many others. Luke has also partnered extensively with nonprofit organizations such as the United Nations Population Fund, CARE International, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In this conversation, Luke and I discuss the lessons he's learned as a stills photographer that have helped him develop as a cinematographer, how to think about investing in gear and networking as an up-and-coming DP, and how he covers a scene as both a single operator versus when he works on larger production teams. And with that, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Luke Forsyth. All right, we ready to roll?
Yeah, man, we're good.
All right, Luke Forsyth, welcome to the Austin Meyer Podcast. It is a pleasure to have you here. And why don't you share with the audience where you're coming from today? Where are we reaching you in the world?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I'm in Vancouver, BC on a beautiful overcast day.
Nice, nice. So, Luke, you are a cinematographer who has worked all over the world. But there's some people who are listening to the show that might not know your work. Oftentimes, the cinematographers on these projects don't really get the limelight. So maybe you could share a little bit of a background on who you are and what you've been working on in the past decade in this documentary industry.
Yeah, man. So I'm Canadian. I grew up in a really small town and sort of fell in love with traveling and backpacking and did that for quite a few years. And then from there, it was sort of a natural transition into documentaries. I started with photography, but for me, the point was always traveling and new experiences and not necessarily the technical craft of image making. So documentaries was always a much better fit for me than something like landscapes. So I spent about 10 years in Asia. And for a lot of that, I was a photojournalist. I was based in, I started in South Korea, and then I moved to Phnom Penh, Cambodia. And I spent 4 years there, building up a photojournalism portfolio. And yeah, I kind of wanted to be like a war photographer. That was always the goal.
Yeah.
And so I followed around political protests and as much, I don't know, action as I could, as maybe you do when you're in your early 20s. Worked a lot for big newspapers. The New York Times was one of my bigger clients. So people like that. But then over the years, I slowly started to fall out of love with the news industry. I think I came into it right as budgets were shrinking and the sort of golden age of news, at least what I was interested in, was disappearing. So I started looking around for what I was going to use my skills for, and documentary video production seemed like a logical extension of photography. I started experimenting with my camera in video mode. Like, I was shooting right as the 5D Mark II kind of revolution was starting.
Yeah.
So I was able to, fortunately just switch my stills camera to video mode and start learning the very basics, shooting small videos for news outlets, little personal projects, nonprofit organization films, things like that. And then eventually I decided I was going to commit fully, and I just wanted to do nothing but video production. So I moved to Mexico City and started advertising myself as a DP. And it took probably like 6 months without much work. But eventually I got a really lucky break and landed my first big gig on a Nat Geo production. And from there, once I started working with teams and seeing how cool it was to work, in a professional documentary environment, I pretty much went all in and stopped going for photo work completely.
Wow. Well, there are so many places already that I'm excited to dive into and kind of enter that synopsis in some more detail on a couple places there. And the first one that I'm interested in is this study of photography. Last year, I had the opportunity myself to take part in a documentary photography workshop. It's called the Missouri Photo Workshop. And I'd encourage any people who are cinematographers out there focusing on video to check this out, because this was really my first study of photography in a formal setting. And I felt like I gained so much insight into the process of just creating frames in a way that I'd never really thought about as a cinematographer. And it helped me develop a new skill set and a new appreciation for the images that I was making. I'm wondering if you could take us back to those early days in your career when you were focusing on photography and how that study has helped you become a better cinematographer down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. That workshop's one of the big ones. I used to love all those things. In fact, I sort of miss that about photography, that workshop ecosystem that exists.
Yeah.
Photography and photojournalism specifically was really everything to the starting of my career. I didn't go to film school. I didn't even go to journalism school or photography school. But without being a photographer, I think I would have had a really hard time. I mean, my first professional production job was for Nat Geo, which I don't think, or National Geographic, which I don't really think is the usual starting place. Yeah. And I think the only reason I was able to sort of jump in like that is because I had, 5 years of professional photography experience. For me, documentary filmmaking is less about technical craft and more... Sorry, the hard part isn't the technical stuff. You can teach yourself how the cameras work and how all of that works on YouTube with time and some dedication.
Right.
But what's really hard is getting access and getting people to agree to be filmed. If you can get 2 feet away from someone with a video camera inside their house while they're going through some difficult situation in their life or something really, earth-shattering, you're going to get good footage. As long as you know how to use the camera. But the hard part is getting into that position. How do you convince a stranger to open up to you and to let you film them, sometimes the most difficult or intimate moments of their life? And so photojournalism, where you're constantly meeting new people and working in unfamiliar environments, a lot of the time by yourself, was such important training for me, because it teaches you that human interaction. And that's what I think is really the most challenging thing about documentaries. Like, if people will agree to let you film them, you've done the hardest part. And then there's the technical part, which, learning how to make a frame in a still is the same concepts apply to video. I think the big shock for me was just adding the extra dimension of audio and the amount of moving parts. But you know, composition is composition. So if you can make a still frame, you need some adjustment time to learn how to shoot in sequences and how to, you know, cover action instead of looking for decisive moments. But light and the basics of how cameras work all transfers over. So I actually think photographers make amazing documentary cinematographers. They need a lot of help sometimes, or a lot of time to get used to the extra technical requirements. But for me, it's a logical transition, because you've got the people skills and you have, you know, the most important cinema principles of light and composition and balance and things like that. I mean, if you're any good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, one of my big learnings, as I was mentioning from that workshop, was I realized when I was working with all these photographers who are mainly still photographers, and I was the one cinematographer, video guy in there, one thing that I realized was how focused on motion I am when I'm capturing video. Like, I'm always thinking about where things are moving and moving with the camera, and I like that. But one of my mentors told me, anytime we're going to freeze the frame, anytime I'm going to pause one of your videos, it doesn't always look like you're super thoughtful about everything having its place. And he encouraged me to start thinking about a frame as like a bento box. Everything has its little place. And now when I'm making frames, I'm starting to think about that a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do that. It's probably subconscious at this point, but I think in the beginning, it was tough because as a photographer, you're trying to look for moments, you know, one decisive moment that will tell the entire story. And in a modern photojournalism environment, you're lucky if you get more than one photo published. You know, they might just take the one very best one. So you're looking to get everything in one. The hard thing coming over, you know, when I first came over into video, I would do the same thing. I would hold one really great frame.
Yeah.
And then not get the details and the cutaways and things like that. You know, you have to learn all of that, and you have to learn to see motion and not just moments. The flip side of that, though, is that because of that photography training, I think I am really conscious of each individual frame. Mm. Now that I've gotten used to the sort of flow of switching shots and getting a big variety of things, like in photography, you would never stop shooting what you're shooting and get a close up of someone's hands. Well, maybe, but like, you know, a lot of the detail shots we shoot in video, or some of the cutaways, you might not shoot in stills. So yeah, you have to retrain your brain to look for a lot more details and information. But at the same time, even as I'm shooting them, that photography training does kick in. And I find myself just constantly scanning the periphery of the frame and just looking, like you said, for everything has that place, and just sort of trying to keep that balance all the time. So It's hard for me to know what it would be like without doing photography, but I'm sure it's influenced, you know, everything about the way I shoot docs.
And then that skill that you were developing when it comes to gaining access, gaining people's trust, making them feel comfortable around you, I can only imagine that was even an extra challenge when you're working in countries that you're standing out as a photographer, as not being from there. You probably don't speak the language. So what are some of the ways that you learned how to approach people and work with people? Like, what are some specific tactics around that have helped you get into those intimate moments to create beautiful images and beautiful video?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to almost put on a sort of persona, which is grounded in reality. You're not lying to people, but you really need to project this air of, it's okay, you can trust me, I'm not here to hurt you. You know, a lot of the times people will say you have five minutes or maybe even 5 seconds to convince someone to let you in. You know, there's this like immediate perception moment between people that when you're approaching them with the camera, they're making snap decisions about, I'm not going to engage with this person, or I am going to engage with this person and I'm curious. So I think, you know, I did a workshop when I first started. You know, I think workshops and things are really important. I did a workshop with a photographer I really admired at the time, and we kind of went on a mock assignment together in Bangladesh. And I just soaked up the way he interacted with people. But by that time, I'd also been traveling as a sort of full-time backpacker for about 4 years. So I was used to, you know, having to be the outsider and not belonging. And I think you just kind of realize that most people out there don't want to hurt you. And if you approach them in an open, friendly, you know, caring way, they react well to it. So, yeah, I think it, you know, is a long process of years of, you know, living in other countries. You know, before I did this, I was an English teacher in South Korea.
Okay.
And South Korea is not a diverse country in the sense that almost everybody's Korean. There really aren't many foreigners. And so you stand out everywhere. And you just kind of get used to that. I think Asia in some ways is a very easy place to learn that skill because it's safe and people are generally very nice and curious about foreigners, whereas some other parts of the world you can get a much more hostile, you know, reception, and it could be a little bit more intimidating. But yeah, by the time I started shooting photography, I already had, you know, 5 or 6 years of that outsider experience.
Yeah. And when you were making that transition into documentary filmmaking, what drove that? Was it a disillusionment with the photography or photojournalism side of things, or was it this allure towards some different type of storytelling that captivated you?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, the cynical part of me was sort of reading the room at the time I was entering the industry. You know, it took me 2 years of portfolio building and then probably another 6 to 8 months after I arrived into Cambodia to even get my first job, you know. So I invested a lot of time and energy and a lot of money into getting started. But as soon as I got my foot in the door, you know, I started looking at other people around me and then looking ahead to trends in the industry and trying to figure out, where is this leading?
Yeah.
You know, it's really exciting when you're going after something, but once you kind of get there and you're shooting for the people that you kind of dreamed of shooting for, you start looking around and you're like, okay, well, do I just keep doing this or what's next?
Right.
And I think I came into photography with that vision of the James Noctue, Don McCullen war photographer character. You know, you're going to fly around the world shooting assignments, and it's going to be, you know, this life of adventure. And it is that, but the industry, I think, in a very positive way, is changing the way it works. And it's not just white guys being sent all around the world to cover things. We're, you know, giving more priority to locals to tell their own stories. And I realized that what I thought I was signing up for was not actually the reality. And I fully support the direction, you know, I encourage it. I think it's the industry's going in the right direction. Yeah. But I wasn't going to live, you know, the illusion that I thought I was getting into, you know, just wasn't the case. And also at the same time, news budgets were shrinking and I was finding, you know, I was living in Cambodia and I was doing okay, but I started to think, okay, with what I'm getting paid here and the amount of work that's coming in a good month, what happens if I ever wanted to, you know, move home? I would be in a lot of trouble trying to go back to Canada on a, you know, photojournalist salary.
Yeah.
It's pretty tough.
Yeah.
So that's the cynical version. I started looking around and going, okay, the things are changing, and I kind of missed the window on what I wanted to get out of this. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, a less, you know, calculating version is that as soon as I got my first taste of shooting video, I realized how powerful it can be when you're telling those stories. Documentary video gets a lot closer to capturing the full experience of what it's like to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I think still photos are super powerful and they can capture a moment in time and tell an amazing story, but they're a little, the experience is a little less rich, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's for me, when I'm the point, like I said, has always been to to have experiences and then communicate those to other people. And so when you're in an intense situation or you're seeing something amazing and it's the sounds and the, you know, the light and the way the people are moving and the energy in the room, and in stills, it wasn't quite as easy to do that. And once I started to see what you could get in video, and, you know, it was really attractive in sort of, I think, capturing the complete experience of the moment. And on top of that, I loved the idea of working in teams.
Yeah.
You know, as a photojournalist, you're by yourself. A lot of the times you'd get an email from an editor saying, you know, you got 2 days to shoot this, no fixer, minimal expenses, go. Mm-hmm. Whereas in video, you tend to be with, you know, rarely are you alone. You know, and sometimes you have teams of 10 people, 15 people. There's exceptions, you know, like the My Octopus teacher or something, who I know you've had on here. It seems like he was on his own. More often than not, you've got a lot of specialists involved, and everyone is really good at their own thing, and together you make this amazing finished product.
Mm-hmm. So I want to transition to when you moved, I believe, to Mexico. Is that what you said, when you were really starting to dive full in to being a documentary cinematographer, and this transition? Because I think there's going to be people listening to this who they have an interest in becoming a cinematographer, starting to do video. And so there are two components that I'd love to hear you reflect on making that big change. The first being like the technical side of things, as you said, when it comes to figuring out how to do sound. Do I need a bunch of new gear? That huge investment. What do I buy? What do I not buy? What's worth it? All that kind of stuff, which can be really intimidating when people are switching over to video. So maybe we can start there, but I do want to go towards, like you mentioned, advertising yourself as a DP, like to start to like create this new reputation for something that you haven't done, to start to get those first jobs. So maybe we can start with just like that initial investment, starting to learn that technical side when you're first becoming a cinematographer.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, my starting point was maybe different than some people's, because I had 5 years of photojournalism experience. So I knew how cameras worked. But gear is a weird one, in that it's really trendy to say gear doesn't matter, but that's not entirely true. I mean, in photography these days, I truly believe the camera doesn't matter almost at all. I mean, as long as it's not terrible. I have, my portfolio has photos from 5 different cameras on there, ranging from, you know, fixed lens point and shoots to full on DSLR packages, and you cannot tell the difference. All cameras are amazing. Video, I also think, like, I don't want to say that you need to get really, really good stuff, but you need a lot more things, I think, to make a decent product right out of the gate. The camera is arguably the least important part, I'd say, you know, but you need decent audio, and you know, a light or two would help a lot. When I was getting started, I first started out using a DSLR, which now I wouldn't recommend. I'd get a mirrorless, obviously. The best one you could afford. My buying strategy used to be whatever the newest one is, buy the last model used. Mm. So, if you're looking at the A7S III, think about an A7S II used. This is if you're just getting started.
Right.
You know, say, don't spend a ton of money, but it still allows you to get something that is really good. Mm-hmm. I would say start there. Start with a used mirrorless camera. Eventually, though, you know, those will make great images. But then if you're going to shoot documentary and you're going to be shooting 5, 6, 10 hours a day, tons of footage following characters, if you decide you really want to get into it and you want to start getting deep and telling stories of people and take it to the next level, you kind of need a dedicated video camera. And so I started small. I got a, you know, they released the FS5 Mark II. I bought an FS5 Mark I used, right? So I used that for a couple of years. And then once I started getting hired on jobs that were asking me for a bigger camera more regularly, then I upgraded. But again, I bought it used. I think my next camera was an FS7 used.
Okay.
Last year is the first time I bought a new camera, actually, and that was an FX9.
Okay.
But in terms of just starting out, I'd say over-investing in gear is a big mistake, because you might not even like it. You know, there's a difference between buying gear for a professional career and when you're just starting. You're not going to get big professional jobs if you don't already have a portfolio, if you don't have a few projects that you've worked on. So you need to get a camera to build up those work samples so that people will agree to take the risk on hiring you. But if you overcommit on gear, you can't afford to shoot anything. So
I would say start
small and then work up slowly when you're getting the volume of work to, or you're ready to make the commitment to justify it because you've spent some time and you know that you're really into it, then get a, you know, a real camera, then invest in bigger stuff and then work your way up from there. And then once you get to like a professional level, then my strategy changes quite a bit and it's buy the very best you can afford because it's now a work tool and it's tax deductible. And the last thing you want is to be shooting on a high budget production and for something to go wrong, you know?
Right.
So you buy the very best that you can because it just works.
Right. And so when you were developing that portfolio in the video space, was that coming in the form of passion projects that you were doing and putting it out there and sending it to people? Were you just cold emailing and saying, hey, I'm in this area. If you don't have someone, but you need someone, I'm your guy. What was that process like?
So I'd shot a lot of video projects to the point, like independent ones, passion projects, I guess you call them. I would shoot video and I had enough where I could put together like a minute and a half sort of reel.
Okay.
And I'd say for anybody starting out, that's the minimum you need to start getting paid work. You know, you need a minute of good stuff. If you can't make a minute for a reel or a minute and a half, you need to go out and shoot more because no one will hire you without some examples. But assuming that you have that, I mean, networking is really important in a documentary career. Nobody's, especially at the high level, nobody is Googling for their DP. You know, these production managers are asking people, either they already know you or they ask someone they trust, hey, who do you know who could do this? And word of mouth is probably responsible for 90% of my jobs. I can't remember the last time I got spontaneously, you know, discovered, hey, we saw your website and we'd love to hire you. That,
right.
At least in my experience, doesn't really happen. So actually how I got my very first real production job was I had been shooting a passion project. I moved to Mexico. I had no work and I knew, you know, I needed a reel that represented being in Mexico. I thought, okay, it's all well and good to have all these shots from Southeast Asia, but I'm trying to work in Mexico. I need a reel from Mexico. So I started inventing personal projects for myself. And one of those was a short film. Well, I guess it was a multimedia project about water shortages in Mexico City. So I hired a local fixer to go out with me. These were in some pretty rough neighborhoods and I didn't want to just wander out alone. So I hired a fixer and we shot for, I don't know, 3 weeks maybe. And, you know, I put the project together. Nobody was really interested. I thought, okay, that was a waste of money. Not a waste of money, but you know, this isn't going anywhere. I tried, didn't work out. And then about 4 months later, I stayed friends with that fixer. And actually, you know, he was my first friend in Mexico City. I had Christmas with him and his family when I first arrived there. And then, you know, 4 or 6 months later, I got a call from him at 10 o'clock at night. And he was working with a National Geographic film crew. He was like, hey, man, you owe me for this. Don't screw me. But the B-cam operator on this shoot just broke his leg and they're desperate for a replacement. I'm giving them your name. Can you do it? And I was like, yes. And he was like, do you know how to use a C300? And I was like, absolutely. And I'd never touched one, you know, one of those classic, one of those classic lies. And he was like, okay, don't screw me on this. And, the producer called me right back and we talked for a minute and, you know, I'm sure they didn't want to hire this random guy with this tiny portfolio, but they were desperate. And, I agreed. And so at 4 o'clock in the morning, a car showed up at my house, took me to Acapulco where they were shooting. And, based on that, I got along really well with the DP of that show, this guy, Pablo Durana, who's probably one of the best adventure cameramen in the world working today.
Yeah.
We got along really well and he started bringing me on as a AC and B cam to shoots, all over the world and basically helped me launch my entire career. Wow. So, you know, knowing Ulises, who's my Mexican friend, got me my first job, and knowing Pablo is pretty much responsible for 9 out of 10 jobs I have today. Mm-hmm. You know, through him, I met producers and directors and production companies and all this. And those are still the people I work for now.
Wow.
So you're never going to make it with just a flat. My experience is that you're not going to make it with a cool reel and, you know, some, you know, a Vimeo staff pick.
Yeah.
That stuff's great and you should be working on passion projects, but it's a documentary production's a team sport. And if you want to get work as a DP and not just make your own films, it's all about knowing people because everyone wants to work with their friends.
Yeah. What was one of the first projects that you worked on? Or you could even take us to an individual scene where you felt like this is the type of work that I want to do as a cinematographer. Like, this is fulfilling me. This is hitting all those things that, like, taking all my experiences that I've had have led to this moment. And like, this is what it's about for me.
Yeah. The very first one, actually.
Nice.
I, like I said, I don't think it's normal for your first job to be for National Geographic. I got lucky. At the same time, I put in a lot of groundwork to get to the point where I think I was capable of taking that job. You know, it wasn't, there was 5 years of international or 6 years of international image making experience and working in, international environments leading up to that. So it's not like I had no relevant experience, but it was the definition of a lucky break. I always make that joke. The guy broke his leg. I'm like, how much more of a lucky break can you get than that? But I feel like luck sort of happens only when you put yourself in a position to take advantage of it. Mm. So for me, that show was, I'd always wanted to work for National Geographic as a stills photographer and I just never quite could. So right off the bat, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that this is finally happening. I'm working for National Geographic. And then I got there and that was the first time I realized how great it is to work in a team. Mm. So I love being around all these professionals in each of their various areas and then together making, this amazing final product. Then on top of that, the subject matter, it was about heroin production in Mexico. And so for me, coming from, an aspiring war correspondent, the excitement of working on sort of risky topics was really exciting. And and the access, when you're an independent photojournalist, it can be really hard to convince people to let you into certain areas. But as soon as you have something like National Geographic behind you, doors just open. And I was like, okay, this is amazing. We are shooting these insane scenes of, heroin being cultivated in these remote villages and guys with big bricks of black tar heroin and, ride-alongs with the army and all this kind of stuff that I'd never had the resources or clout to sort of get before.
Right.
And so the whole thing, being with these super talented people working on this exciting, at the time, dangerous stuff was exciting for me. And I changed my opinion on that through experience, but everything just sort of combined. And I was like, as soon as I got back from that trip, I remember talking to my mom who came down for a visit and being like, I'm going straight for that now. I'm done with what I'm doing. And I think I switched my website over within a couple of months and basically, you know, put Luke Forsyth instead of Luke Forsyth is a photojournalist who can shoot video is Luke Forsyth is a, I forget what I called myself in the beginning, but it, you know, I think I probably said videographer or something, but it was video first. And I kind of, yeah, I went all in.
When you approach a scene, when you arrive on set, and I'll put that in quotes, what are some of the things that go through your mind as you're figuring out how to capture that scene? And maybe you can give us a case study of like a particular scene, a particular conversation, or a particular action sequence. Kind of, I want to like get in your head a little bit as you think through different types of shots or how to capture that scene.
Yeah, I guess it depends on a lot of factors. You know, are you shooting by yourself or is there a B cam? Because if you've got two cameras, you know, you can kind of share responsibilities and one person can be capturing, you know, you can leave your B cam to capture the details for you and the cutaways and the close-ups while you stick more to the action. Mm-hmm. If you're shooting verite by yourself with one camera, then it's much more complicated because not only do you need to get all the action that's happening and not miss the important story beats, but you also need to be constantly changing angles and getting cutaways. Mm. You know, it's
so let's just take for example, say you're doing verite, you're the only camera person. You're maybe you're in a room, you're in a single room. What are just some of the things that like bounce through your head? You even said right there, like cutaway shots. So walk us through some of those for people that might not have a deep grasp on it.
Yeah, I mean, as a single operator, assuming you don't have a sound guy with you, I'd say the very first thing is to make sure your sound is running. You know, get headphones in, get a lav on your character, because the audio, when you're by yourself and you're constantly changing shots, the audio is going to do the heavy lifting of the story and it's going to cover up your cut points. If you miss someone, you know, if you're not pointing at someone at the time they're saying something and you don't have clean audio, you've lost the story. So right off the bat, dial in the audio, make sure you're listening to it, make sure it's working. That gives you a lot more freedom to sort of experiment. If it's a simple setup, you know, I would try and make sure I have the essence of, you know, the essence of the action covered. So whatever's happening, make sure you have your basic medium shot of what it's all about. So if it's, you know, if it's someone, if it's a process, make sure you've captured all the different stages of that process so that your bases are covered. And then I start going in for the details. You know, sometimes if I see something that's catching my eye, you know, I'll get a cutaway or a detail right away. But you just want to make sure that you have the basic action covered and that you're not missing some important part of the process. But you know, repeating in my head always wide, medium, tight, and making sure you've got that variety of shots, because it can be really easy to just get stuck on your medium and do the reality TV, you know, follow the ball thing where you just kind of track the guy.
Yeah.
And your editor, you know, they're going to hate you in post because there's nothing to work with.
Yeah.
So as long as your audio is tight, which is going to do the heavy lifting of the storytelling, you know, you get your medium, you get a bit of the action, but then looking for interesting details, whether that's a picture hanging on the wall, you know, burn marks on the guy's hands, a tattoo, whatever, you know, like something that he's wearing, a stain on his shirt, whatever. Story is king, right? And so whatever is going to help give more layers and texture and depth to that story, the better. So constantly looking for those details that might bring, you know, if a guy's a mechanic, you know, there's the oil stains on his hands, there's the dirty jumpsuit, there's the, you know, the sort of the tools, you know, all these things that add extra layers. And then on top of that, if you're a single operator shooting verite, you need to somehow move around enough to trick people into thinking there might be more than one camera there.
Right.
So not just getting glued to one place, which can happen a lot. You know, you've got your zoom lens going on and you get in your corner and there's nice backlight coming in and you just kind of zoom in and out and grab details and all that. And, you know, you can get stuck. So get what you need from a spot. The audio's working. It's covering your story. Move, come around to the other shoulder. Don't break the line. Imagine that there were two cameras working. Where would that second camera be? And move around and cover a scene like you're not a single operator.
Yeah.
So it can get pretty physical and pretty hectic, but you know, it's a lot of variety and a lot of eye for details, I'd say.
And that's where I think that having experience editing is so important for cinematographers. So you have an understanding of like what that editor on the back end is going to need to complete that scene. I know for me, one of the things that I'm trying to get better on is covering a conversation between multiple people as a single operator and having the right intuition, like really listening while I'm behind camera to know when are the moments to move to the other angle, to get that like key line of dialogue where I'm have the camera on the person saying it, or to get that interesting reaction from someone listening, and to know when those moments are right to make those moves. And then once you make the move, like sticking with it, like trusting and just like taking a beat to have a nice frame before moving is something that I'm continually trying to work on.
Yeah. And I mean, I just keep drilling down in audio. A producer I worked with once did me a huge favor by telling me off for not monitoring audio on headphones. And I was mad at the time. I was kind of irritated to be scolded, but he was totally right. It sucks to say as a DP, but the audio is probably more important than the video in terms of storytelling. Mm. You know, you can cover up a lot with cutting to different shots and stuff, but the audio is going to keep the story moving. And so if you're a solo operator, like capturing two people having a conversation, for example, it can be, especially when you're starting out, it might seem like your best bet is to just get a two shot of the guys talking and then just hold that the whole time, because you need to see, you know, every part of the conversation. But that's not the most dynamic or interesting shot. You know, I've learned over the years that as long as the audio is getting everything, you're much better off coming around and getting a over the shoulder, interesting frame with some depth to it of the person talking, and then reposition and kind of move back and forth as the conversation, you know, unfolds, knowing that the audio is going to be there. And then with a couple of cutaways at the end to hide those points where you're repositioning.
Yeah.
I think, it's just thinking how an editor would cover a conversation, you know. Mm-hmm. Do they want just one shot the whole time of two people talking, or would they rather go back and forth to over the shoulders,
right,
with a cutaway in between?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So not being so timid about missing everything that you don't take the time to make it look good, you know? Otherwise you're just shooting reality.
And the projects that you've worked on, not only have you worked on ones like that National Geographic project you were talking about where you're with the team and you're kind of doing it together. You also mentioned the first time we spoke to each other off the podcast about working on one of my favorite documentary series that I've seen called The Trade. And that one, you were doing pickups. You were, you know, filling in gaps from a story that's already been captured. In both those scenarios, I imagine each particular series has a visual style, a visual language. I'm curious, in what ways are those visual languages communicated to you as a cinematographer? And then how do you try to execute and match the style, the feel, the look of such varying projects?
Yeah, The Trade. So just, you know, just so people don't get the wrong idea, I wasn't the DP on The Trade. I was one of the secondary DPs. You know, Matt Porwall made The Trade and he also did Cartel Land, you know, and Matt, you know, really set the tone for how that whole thing would look. I think, you know, if you're working on a project with really talented, smart people like Matt, we had like an hour phone call before I went off to shoot those pickups, and he explained to me what they wanted and how they were shooting it.
So lenses, like on sticks or on shoulder, like all that kind of stuff is what you're going through in a conversation.
Yeah,
like
well, he told me what they had, and so I could figure out they were shooting all on C300s, and I was using Sony stuff. Sometimes I had access to their gear, but there was a shoot where I had to use my own gear, and I had Sony stuff. But I knew what they were shooting and how they were shooting it, so I could, you know, make sure to try and shoot in a way that would make it fit. Mm-hmm. You know, I did another show called The Business of Drugs for Netflix. And the DP there, you know, this guy, Fred Menu, who sort of got well known for shooting Anthony Bourdain shows, one of the best documentary DPs I've ever worked with. And that guy knows exactly what he wants. So when we had the phone call for shooting on The Business of Drugs, he called me and said, like, things, he was asking me what lenses I had, and he would say things down to, okay, use your zoom like a variable prime. If you put in a zoom, the editor might be tempted to use it. So no crash zooms at all, because I can't guarantee they won't put it in there. Like, he knew exactly how he wanted it to look.
Oh, wow.
From the beginning. And he was like, you know, he was very clear in communicating that. So the very best DP and the very best DPs in documentaries, I think, approach it not from a let's show up and just hoover up everything that's happening, but with a specific, you know, style and look in mind that they're trying to consistently capture. It's like it's a Hollywood approach,
yeah,
without a Hollywood studio. You know, I can't speak for them, but I just from my conversations with guys like that and how I try to be now on my shoots where I am the series DP, I try to be a lot more intentional and not just let's see what happens, but how do I want it to look? How am I going to make that happen? And if things go off course, then so be it. Be flexible and flow with it. But, you know, kind of like a script or a style guide, how should this be if I can control it? And then that helps you stay on track and kind of keep a unified aesthetic and style all the way through, even if you have to have other shooters working on it.
That's interesting. And so when you're creating that look, do you create a mood board? Do you watch other movies that might be in a similar genre or maybe even a way different genre and like use those for inspirations? Or what's your process for coming up with that as a series DP?
Yeah, first I write out, not all shows, but when I have the time and luxury, like if you're coming on to a series that's already established, they have their look and you shoot to it. But if I'm starting something from scratch or if you're shooting a feature or something, yeah, I like to first write out my thoughts. You know, what shows have I liked, or what docs or movies, doesn't have to all be documentary. What things have I liked recently? What are some of my, you know, inspirations? What would I like it to be like if I could have total control? Mm-hmm. So sort of I find writing helps me organize my thoughts. And then from there, you know, obviously this is for a substantial project, not a 3-day shoot or something.
Yeah.
But for a big project, then I start gathering visual examples and screen grabs and stuff like that. Like I'm working on a personal show right now that I'm trying to get made. And I've been grabbing stills from everywhere. Like I find Last Chance U, for example, has been giving me a ton of inspiration for how to shoot docs in a sort of different and highly cinematic way. Mm-hmm. There's an app called Milanote that I find really useful for organizing things like that. Mm-hmm. Just pulling in stills and little bits of writing, even audio, and creating a mood board is a DP's version of a script. And I always say in docs, it's great to have a plan. Mm. When you just show up and start spraying and praying, it's a mess in the edit. You need to have a plan, but you can't script reality. So you have to be willing for that plan to change and move with it. But you need to have it. You need to have an idealized version thought out so that on those moments where you arrive somewhere and you're not sure where to start, or everyone looks at you and goes, okay, what next? Mm-hmm. You have something to fall back on.
Ah, I love that. And that's something that, you know, I need to continue developing, is is that sense of planning and just that being comfortable planning. Because I think that I, as a cinematographer, thrive so much on the just like, I'm going to just show up and I'm going to capture it and I'm going to do it. And thinking ahead of time and taking that time to plan and develop your vision, everything like that, develop this, you know, have an understanding of story before you go out into the field is so beneficial. So I think that's huge as well.
You know, I think it's going to be project dependent. Sorry to cut you off.
No, you're good.
You know, like there'll be jobs where someone's like, hey, we've got, you know, this one day shoot branded content for a dishwashing company or something. Or, I don't know, whatever. There'll be these jobs where, okay, yeah, you just show up, you listen to what the director wants and, you know, just wing it. But if you want something to, you know, be not just okay, but great, mm-hmm. you know, if you want your doc to look like Last Chance U, first get a ton of money and a lot of people.
Yeah.
you know, I almost guarantee that guy thought ahead of time. I forget the DP's name.
Terry Zumwalt, I believe it is.
Yeah. I've read a couple interviews with them, and I know that they thought about it, you know, everything down how the interviews would look to how they would cover things mm-hmm. to the kind of gear they wanted, you know, it was all intentional. And if you want your projects to go to that next level, sit down with the director, talk about the story, you know, think about mood, find some visual examples and get on the same page. And so that you're shooting with intention and, you know, not just letting circumstance dictate everything.
So Luke, where are you at these days with your storytelling journey? I know you're now back in Canada. You got an upstart YouTube channel that I'd encourage everyone out there listening to check out. And then, as you said, you're always trying to get your own show. I'm sure you're also working as a freelancer. So what are ways that these days you're trying to grow and develop in your own craft?
Yeah, these are interesting times, I think, for everybody. I'm in Vancouver now, back in Canada after almost 15 years outside the country. So that in itself was a bit of a shock. I also moved back 2 weeks before the COVID lockdown started. So then that also was, you know, pretty intense to be in a new city back at home after a really long time and then suddenly locked in an apartment with like two pieces of IKEA furniture.
Yeah.
You know, and also to boot, I had an extremely intense near-death experience on a shoot in Mexico right before I moved back. So it was all this sort of perfect storm of almost dying and being in shock, moving home after so long, and then a pandemic. It was like, whoa, it was a lot to deal with. And then for about a year, I mean, for about 6 months, work dried up completely. There was nothing. And so that was, you know, I went from shooting 200 days a year in Mexico and working all the time to really not doing anything at all. And was barely even able to leave the house to shoot my own stuff.
Wow.
So yeah, it was a real period of transition in a lot of ways. I think one of the things that it revealed to me was that only working as a DP on other people's stuff limits your control over your creative output in that you're reliant on someone else to give you permission to work because you're just waiting for that email or that phone call. And when all that stopped, I was like, you know, oh wow, I'm not in control of my output. And so that led to a few different paths. One was, you know, I started up a YouTube channel partly because while I was in lockdown, I was just watching so much YouTube and, you know, I'm self-taught. So I learned so much that I thought, okay, why don't I contribute back to this conversation and actually add something rather than just being a consumer? And on top of that, it allows me to sort of, you know, we're not winning Emmys for cinematography on YouTube, but at least you're flexing that creative muscle and you're thinking about, you know, you're being creative and you're producing stuff instead of just passively waiting.
Yeah.
So that was one thing that started. I mean, I have a very tiny channel. I'm not some big shot.
You're starting somewhere. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about.
Not some big shot YouTuber, but that was in response to sort of losing all control over my professional life. I was like, okay, I can make this. This is mine. Mm-hmm. I can make this on my own terms and no one can stop me from making it.
Yeah.
And I've also started to get a lot more interested in directing and show running, which is bringing my own, you know, kind of comes from the same place. I need to start generating my ideas so that I'm not the one waiting for people to call me and hire me onto their jobs. Mm-hmm. I need to be the ones, you know, I want to start being the one creating the jobs.
Yeah.
I don't want to stop shooting. Mm-hmm. I think there's a way to, the camera is the most fun part of it for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm in the process of selling a show right now, or hopefully selling it. And the actual legwork of being a showrunner and director and the meetings and the, you know, the endless phone calls are not my favorite part of the process.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's all just trying to make stuff. And when you're only a DP for hire, especially if you live in a place like Canada, where there isn't a lot of high-end documentary production, a lot of reality TV, but not a lot of like what I consider really high-end documentary.
Yeah.
You sort of need to take control over the narrative to make sure that you're not just passively waiting there, because, you know, if I didn't do something, I would just have to go shoot Pamela Anderson's home renovation or, you know, resource extraction shows, which is not why I got into filmmaking in the first place.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been a big period of change. I think exciting things are coming. I'm going to, you know, I want to keep shooting. I want to keep making stuff, but sort of hopefully a little bit more on my own terms.
Absolutely.
But maybe we're through this pandemic almost. And, you know, I haven't stopped taking freelance cinematography jobs. You know, I've just started to be a little more intentional and taking ones that I think have value, and not just trying to make a dollar any way I can by being a guy holding a camera.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's inspirational for me to hear too, because I think as I'm developing my experience as a cinematographer and watching directors and watching showrunners lead projects, I'm always trying, like, taking my notes, eventually, you know, wanting to take that leap and try something new like you are as well. Before I get to the last question on the podcast, which is one question that I ask everyone, before I get to that, where can people find you? Where can we send them if they want to engage more with what you are creating? Yeah, where should we send him?
Yeah, so I've been on YouTube, I guess, is where I'm putting a lot of my social media energy. I kind of have had a love-hate relationship with social media for a while, and it's gotten to the point where I just try and stay off of it for the most part. Like, I have, luckily my name, Luke Forsyth, and Luke is French, so L-U-C, and a super Scottish last name is like very unusual, and I'm pretty sure I'm the only person in the world with that particular combination. At least I haven't found another one. And so, you know, if you want to find me, if you type in L-U-C Forsyth, you know, I'm the only guy who pops up. I got the .com, the Gmail, the @ handle. But, you know, I maintain like an Instagram and a website presence, but I'm not super active there, but YouTube, I'd say, is where I actually produce stuff.
Yeah.
I put out new videos each week. I'm trying to think about my rationale behind that is, what information would I have needed, 7 years ago? Because when I was looking to, when I thought I'd love to get into documentary filmmaking, it was pretty hard to find information.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at least I find Instagram and whatever, Twitter and stuff, to be a little bit, I don't know, fake, I guess. You know, it doesn't really provide any value for me. But making videos that myself 7 years ago could have gotten value from, I think, is something I can feel pretty good about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very long answer, but YouTube is the way to go. Just search for that L-U-C Forsyth and you'll find me pretty much everywhere.
And if you're listening to this podcast and you've enjoyed today's conversation, I think you'll really enjoy Luke's channel. And YouTube is an amazing resource, to learn. And there's so many people who talk about video, who talk about video production, cinematography. But I think there's true value in the specificity of where that video is. You know, what's at the heart of that video, whether it's documentary or real estate videos, there's specificity and nuance that's really important. And I know I get a lot of value out of even a video, you know, you talking about what it means to create a carnet. Like, I've never done that before when you're traveling with a bunch of gear, because I haven't needed to bring that much gear before. And so I think those specific tactics that are in some of the videos you're putting out and are super valuable. So I'd encourage everyone to check that out if you've enjoyed today's conversation.
Yeah, most of the videos that I've been making are literally that. You know, when I'm working with ACs and people, every time they ask me questions that maybe I've sort of take for granted at this point, I'm like, oh, that's interesting to you. And then I'll write it down in this running document. Mm-hmm. And so I have pretty much an endless supply of topics. I mean, I think YouTube isn't where you go to post your award-winning cinematography masterpiece. You know, there's still a lot of value to working in the traditional system, because you can bring the, you know, you get Netflix on board, you can bring resources to bear to make incredible work. Mm-hmm. But for education, I think it's, you know, the best resource out there.
Yeah. Well, Luke, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. The question that I like to end each podcast with is, if you had one last piece of advice for people who want to become better storytellers, or in the context of this conversation, one last piece of advice for people who want to become better cinematographers, what would you offer them?
Oh man, the surprise wrap-up question. In terms of becoming better storytellers, I mean, I think for me, it's really to capture, like, the, I don't know, the truth of an experience, I guess, or like the you need to be able to empathize. Like, I think empathy, you don't have to like the people you're filming, you know, you don't have to, you know, I've shot with assassins, for example, you know, and you're like, you're a bad person, and I really don't like you, and I'm not really comfortable with you, but I can still have empathy for you. I can see that you came from a really rough part of the world and were born into extreme poverty, and you had very few options. Mm-hmm. And if I was in your position, if I grew up in a slum in Juarez, you know, one of the most dangerous cities in the world, and my options were making 80 cents a day as a fruit packer in some warehouse, and then someone came along and said, hey, 17-year-old, come with me. I'll give you $1,000 a week and all the cars and, you know, women you can handle or whatever. What decision would I have made? Mm-hmm. So to be, I think, you know, you need to be able to, at least, you don't have to condone what people are doing. You don't have to like everybody, but if you can try and just understand where they're coming from, I think it, you know, I think it's crucial to being a good storyteller and conveying that experience to other people. Because if you're just, you know, only looking at things through your own eyes, you know, it's going to be really hard to get to the core of whoever that character is.
Absolutely. Well, that's great advice, Luke. Thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer podcast. And to everyone out there listening, go out and tell some stories.
Thanks, man. That was fun.
That's it for episode 48 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to Luke for joining the show, and to you for listening. What'd y'all think of that conversation? What were some of your takeaways? If you're watching on YouTube, drop a comment. Let us know what you thought. We'll be reading those. And for those listening to the pod, send me a message. What stood out to you? I'm at Austin Meyer Films across social. I know for me, one of the parts of our conversation that resonated the most was what Luke emphasized as really the keys to his success as a cinematographer. The skill of being able to approach people and develop trust, getting access to remarkable people and compelling moments, the ability to understand story and empathize with the people you're filming, understanding light and framing. And the cool thing is that with all of those are things that you can practice wherever you are and with whatever gear you have. And there's no better time to start than now. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please consider leaving a rating and review, commenting, sharing the show with a friend. Let me know. Who do you want to see on the podcast? What themes do you want to cover? I'm excited to get this pod rolling again. I'll see you soon. And until then, go out and tell some stories.